Welcome to Project I Am. Today, I am interviewing April Carley. April is the senior pastor of Mustard Seed, a church here in Austin, Texas. Together, April and I discuss mental health needs and Christians and the church as a whole, and some of the obstacles and stumbling blocks that exist with regards to Christians getting good mental health services. So grab that coffee, that smoothie, or that green tea, and get ready to hear from April Carley. You're going to love her. She's one of the best people on the planet.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome.
Please note that while I am a mental health professional and educator, this podcast and the information shared within it I intended solely for information, education, and entertainment purposes. The content discussed does not constitute therapy, counseling, or any form of professional mental health services. It should not be used as a substitute for therapy or personalized mental health treatment. If you are in need of support, please consult with a licensed therapist or appropriate healthcare professional. April, thank you so much for being here today. For everybody that is listening, I have known April since before my youngest kid was born. So before Levi was born, April, that makes it about almost 18 years. If we go 18. Back to 2007.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I think you're my longest American friend.
Oh, that's an honor.
It's an honor for me for sure. And I just think of all the times our families hung out. And so thank you so much. There was a noise in the background. Let me switch on do not disturb, which doesn't always work. Thank you so much for doing this and agreeing to meet. And I think, you know, you and I have a history together with being in church from leadership capacities, in non-leadership capacities. And right now you are currently the lead pastor at a particular church. Can you start by sharing a bit about your role as a pastor and your journey in ministry?
Yeah, so I am a pastor at a church in Austin called Austin Mustard Seed. That church is about 11 years old. I came into that role the way I come into most of my leadership roles, accidentally, unintentionally. And that was 6 years ago, right about a year before COVID, when our founding pastor quite unexpectedly moved away. No scandal, nothing. Nothing like that. It was just what his family needed for some physical health reasons. You know, Austin is not a friendly place for people with seasonal allergies. Some pretty significant health problems for them. So they moved somewhere better for them. And up until very recently, I was co-pastoring, but now I'm in this role on my own, but with a leadership team. And we are actually about to shift from kind of a more conventional Sunday morning setting to a Sunday evening dinner church. So eating around tables and discussing scripture. And we're already pretty casual, but we'll be even more. Yeah, but I grew up, I'm a pastor's kid. So I've been in ministry all my life or in a ministry role adjacent all my life. I was on staff at a church right after Matt and I got married, a church plant. Then I was in a house church with you and your family for like a decade.
The best of times.
It really was. I still say that. Yeah.
And April, as you tell me about that, one of the things that both you and I are aware of, and I know you've been part of various traditions, various Christian church traditions, right? Some more open to women in ministry and some less so. Tell me a little bit about your journey to, and the difficulties with being a female pastor that is the lead pastor in an organization.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, a tricky question, because our church is Baptist, which is already a triggering word to a lot of people. We are not Southern Baptist. It doesn't matter to most people when that word Baptist comes out of your mouth that everyone thinks it's Southern Baptist. We are a Texas Baptist, which are open to women in leadership roles. Obviously, we have to be, or I couldn't be doing what I'm doing. And then when Matt and I first got married, we were Episcopal. Episcopalians are open to women in leadership. House church was house church, you know. You and I were kind of leading that house church together, I think.
Yeah, kind of
maybe unofficially.
Right, unofficially.
Kind of unofficially,
pretending we weren't, but really, subtly, yeah, right?
Really, we were. And I was in a youth group at a church that was complementarian, you know, theologically. So women were not allowed leadership roles, but I was a leader in that youth group. Like I was officially selected as a, you know, leader in the youth group. So I think that was maybe, I wouldn't have said it at the time, but probably a confusing thing for me as a girl. And then in YWAM, I was in Youth with a Mission. I'm not sure what YWAM officially teaches about women in leadership, but I was definitely, you know, taught the same things that the men were being taught with me about, you know, Christian roles and leading. So it's been an interesting journey for me. And I think that there's still a lot to be done, even in spaces that are egalitarian.
Sure.
Right. I think there's just a lot of unrooting and dismantling of misogyny and patriarchy in both men and women, blind spots and things that we're not aware of.
I think that's really interesting just to hear a Christian speak about misogyny and patriarchy. Those are words that you don't normally hear Christians talking about in a way that infers that those are bad things. And,
oh, sure.
And I know, and yeah. I have my own bias and trauma and, you know, stuff coming in that impacts my view on that. But I'm pretty sure that those things, doesn't matter how brilliant and open your church is, the fact that, you know, you mentioned there's still work to be done in the areas of misogyny and patriarchy, surely that has to impact not just your mental health, but the mental health of people in the congregation as a whole.
Yes. And we have lost people specifically around those things. Some of them have named them specifically. Some of them have not. But I don't think that they've been aware of being able to name those things specifically. And the more people who have been able to name those things for me, the more I've been able to see them. I think I was resistant to it at first. Like, no, I mean, look, I'm one of the pastors and I preach and we have women on our leadership team and I don't use pronouns for God when I preach. I'm really careful about that. I'm careful about editing out anything like that in our prayers. Like we don't do extemporaneous prayers. We do red prayers. I've even gotten to the point where in most of our red prayers, I have edited out like a gender, any gender term. So addressing people like brothers and sisters, I'll say friends, things like that. Like I'm just really trying to strip any gendered language out because I know that even if that's not maybe harmful to me or to 3/4 of the people in the room, if it's harmful to a handful, it's kind of like the whole meat sacrifice to idols thing. Mm. If it's going to hurt a few people, then why not? Then why are we doing it? It's not necessary. I've seen it more and more. I was talking to my therapist about it. I was like, I don't want this to become a like, well, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail kind of thing now. I want to be really cautious about that in myself. Mm. And she said, once you see it, you can't not see it.
Absolutely. And I, as you talk about that, what occurs to me is how much intentionality and labor that requires. It's not something for most of us with backgrounds in the church, it's not something that's automatic. You really have to be aware. And when you see it, you have to choose to do something about it, right? Even if you see it everywhere, it requires hard work to take action to do something about it.
Yeah. To me, it doesn't feel hard. It feels like a loving action. Like if one of my children said, mom, like I'm thinking about my kids when they were small. If they said, mom, when you put me in my car seat in this way, it's uncomfortable. It hurts me. Like it physically is hurting me when you put me in my car seat in a hurry, in a rush, and the car seat's hot, like whatever. I would take measures to put them in their car seat in a different way. To cool the car off first, to slow down, to not be in such a hurry, whatever it is that I need to do. And so this feels like that.
I love that because what you're saying is it's motivated by love and care. And when we motivated by love and care and by compassion, then things that might have seemed like hard work are a lot easier.
Right.
So pivoting a bit to mental health and the church and Christians in general, in your experience, what are some of the most pressing mental health needs amongst Christians today, or at least what you're aware of?
Right. So I think there's a lot. I think it depends on the tribe that you're part of. So I can speak maybe to the tribe that I'm in. And I think the tribe I'm part of, which is more middle of the road, more progressive, more deconstructing, younger millennial, and we're bringing in some Gen Zs now, people. There's a lot of people who've experienced spiritual abuse and know it. And that has led to anxiety, depression, self-doubt in themselves. Those are things that I've experienced as well. And I think that maybe older generations, boomers, and even some people in our age group,
Which
are
is
not as
young,
aware, which is
yeah,
so young.
which is so young, our age group, right? So, I mean,
I think we're not as aware of those things.
right. For our listeners, right, some of whom may have some experience in the church, some who may not, how would you define spiritual abuse or conceptualize that for us?
Spiritual abuse or church hurt, it kind of depends on who you're talking to, is abuse that happens specifically at the hands of a clergy or in a church environment, a church leader under church authority, spiritual, any kind of spiritual authority. So it could also happen, it doesn't have to be in a Christian environment, but that's my area. So those are the people who I'm encountering. It could be a like a cult or something like that as well. So it's someone who is using God as their like leverage to hurt people. And it's not always, I would say that oftentimes when clergy are hurting people, or church leaders, it's not always necessarily officially a clergy person. They're not doing it with the intention of hurting people. They are doing it from a genuine place of wanting to help. And that is part of what makes it even so much more harmful, because everybody is locked into this system of like kind of tricking themselves into thinking that what they are doing is actually good and beneficial to themselves, to each other, to the greater faith community, to the world. And yet you know somewhere in yourself that it's not good, it's not healthy, it doesn't feel good, but then you trick yourself into thinking, no, this is good, this is right, this is what I should be doing. And it's just this constant cycle of, and then that's where you begin to teach yourself, don't trust myself, I can't trust myself, I am not trustworthy. That leads to anxiety, depression. But then you can't trust other people to go to talk about those things. You have to stay within the church for the some stay in the church for those things. Anyway,
I mean, I
it's
think
very unhealthy. It's
it's
so
really
unhealthy.
it's so unhealthy. And I think part of the challenge with recovering from that and what makes it so insidious is the person telling you these things is normally somebody that you think represents God to some degree or speaks with the authority of God to some degree. And at least in some traditions, that's the way those people show up. And so, whether we like it or not, whether we realize it or not, there's some part of us that believes that disobeying this person is akin to disobeying God.
We've given this person permission to cross our boundaries.
Wow. And so the result of that, right, is anxiety, depression, lack of trusting yourself, so many things. And like you just mentioned, oftentimes people in this situation can't speak to anybody in the church about it because of the dynamics that are at work there. And then traditionally, depending on the tribe that you're part of, some churches or some tribes have a negative perspective of mental health practitioners and are discouraged from seeking mental health help outside the church. Talk to me a little bit about that.
So, this is not the case where I am now at all. Which I'm very grateful for a lot. But I would say experientially, there is a mistrust of mental health experts because we should just be able to rely on God for these things. It's almost like we want to separate our minds from our bodies and our spiritual selves from our bodies. There's not an integration of those things. And I don't even think the Bible teaches that. So I think that's actually really bad theology. not going to go so far as to say it's a heresy, but I think it might be.
So, I mean, I
like
totally.
Scripture says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. And
Right.
if one of those parts of us is not healthy, then we need to go seek the person, the expert who can help us get healthy in that part of ourselves. And that's not always clergy, right? Like if my body was sick, I would go to a physician. So why shouldn't I go to a mental health expert when my mind is sick?
Well, I think that's because a lot of people that we're talking about in this situation have some misconceptions regarding mental health and how mental health shows up or how to address mental health issues. What are some of those misconceptions that you hear about or that you've seen, not in your church per se, because you know, you guys are doing really well and even you go to therapy, which is so phenomenal. Even you is, you know, but what are some of the misconceptions you've heard about?
Right. I think there's just there has been such a mistrust of, and I think it's been culturally in general, like calling a psychiatrist a shrink, like they're going to shrink your brain, you know, those sorts of things. So I think that the church and the culture have been similar over decades of time of not wanting to trust a psychiatrist, not wanting to take medication for your mental health. It's really a culture of individualism that and I can't speak to other countries, but the West, probably the United States, we think that we can white knuckle and just push through these sorts of things. And when you are in a faith tradition, when you're a Christian specifically, you want to bring God in to that and be like, well, God is going to help me white knuckle through this depression, through this anxiety, through this schizophrenia.
Right.
I mean, like, whatever it is, that obviously, when it gets out of hand, God is not, I believe God can heal people miraculously. But I think more often than not, God uses the tools that we have, which are therapists, psychiatrists, medication.
So help me with this, because this is where I think I have a blind spot, bias, prejudice. I know this. I'm working on it. But one of my challenges that I experience is that many, and not your church, right? So I'm talking about...
Sure. You don't always have to say that, but that's
okay. Okay, good. I'm not going to say that every time, but faith traditions in general... They want, Christian faith traditions want their leaders in those congregations, oftentimes in particular streams, want their congregation to, if they need counseling, to get it from their pastor, like to receive pastoral counseling or to see a Christian therapist. And here's my challenge with that as a counselor educator and having been a pastor, you know, full time before. I'm aware of the lack of training that many pastoral counselors have in mental health and how many things are oversimplified. You know, and before I went into the master's program and became an LPC and then a counselor educator, I considered taking the Christian counseling route. And when I found out that the curriculum was on personality assessment and was very limited and came from one view only, you know, I changed my mind and I went the state licensure way and the full education way. And my concern with that is people who go that route and are accredited with, for example, the American Christian Counseling Association, have minimal training and yet can hang up their shingle as Christian counselors and see people and might very well be ill-equipped to handle things that are actually pretty complicated.
Yes, yes, yeah. And not to mention the letters that you can continue to add after your name, right? Like the certificates that you can continue to get, like in different modalities, in different types of therapy that a Christian counselor is not going to do. Because they have to get that first, they have to get that first degree first and then begin pursuing these other things. But you were preaching to the choir on that.
Sure.
So I think that's a huge problem. I think that speaks to a blind spot in the Christian world at large, which doesn't seem to, and again, I think that we tend to separate our emotional, spiritual, mental health from our bodies. Because if I had strep throat, I would call a Christian friend and say, I have strep throat. Will you pray for me? I feel terrible. I have a fever. My throat hurts so bad. I can't swallow anything. It's miserable. I can't sleep. And I would go to the doctor and get antibiotics.
Sure.
I would not stop at calling my friend and saying, will you pray for me?
Right.
And I also wouldn't call my friend and be like, can you talk to me about strep throat?
I hear you. I hear you. I know because I know you. I know that we're preaching to the choir. Many of the people listening to this podcast are counselors, counseling students, and just general people out there. If you could help non-Christian counselors understand the needs of Christian clients that come to them and things that they need to be aware of, what would you possibly say that it's important for them to know from a counselor educator perspective? You know, the things that we teach is to set aside, you know, all counselors to set aside their own personal values, their biases, to bracket them out. And that's an intellectual exercise that can be successful or not. But understanding the worldview of your clients is crucially important. What do counselors need to understand about Christians coming to them for counseling?
That's hard. I think that for some, there is a resistance, hesitation around need. And that is because if I need this therapy, medication, whatever, to feel good, then that means I am failing in my faith. Also, I'm not like, it's like, it has to do with being a good Christian, and it has to do with having like enough faith. I mean, I was just at an event a couple weeks ago where I heard not about mental health, about like praying for people who are sick, and some of this, like, don't, and there was talk about don't feel this way as we pray for these people. But the way it was said in a way that was like, I almost feel like you're telling us that we should feel this way, you know? So there's a lot of very, in my opinion, tricky language in the Christian world that deposits thoughts in people's heads that cause them to doubt themselves. I don't know how else to say it. I think there's just so much self-doubt. And rather than pointing people to trust God, it is don't trust yourself. But you should trust God, but it's never really clear what it means to trust God. And I believe that oftentimes the way that we trust God is to trust other people. Because God created us to be in community, and I hear God through other people. I hear affirmation about things, about myself, about decisions, whatever, through others, and more often than just like me sitting in a room going, oh, God just spoke to me.
Right. And I think something that people forget is that if the wound came in through a person, the healing is going to come in through a person, right? And that's what community is about. That's what therapy is about, you know, which is why it is so, that community aspect is so vitally important. But if you're told, or if you learn that you can't trust people, or that you can't trust yourself, there's an abdication of autonomy that happens in those situations that can be really harmful for people. Yes. And it actually shipwrecks their faith.
Right. Yes. And that's what I've seen happen repeatedly, is people walk away. Some of them I do think are actually getting healthier. Some of them I don't think are getting healthier. I think that they are abandoning their faith and they're exchanging it for an alternative that is not actually any healthier. It just maybe in the moment feels healthier because it's different, but it's the same. It's the same old, it's the same thing. They're just picking up another unhealthy practice or something, but I understand why they need to do it.
Yeah. No, I get that. So when you being a pastor, people come to you. You know, you and I have spoken about spiritual direction before. People come to you for spiritual direction. They come to you for help. How do you know when to encourage them to seek professional mental health help and when not to.
I probably err on the side of telling them to seek help because of my own lack of, or just knowing, like, I don't want to be leading you astray. So go see a therapist. No, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm probably downplaying what I do know.
Yeah, I think you
I've
are.
had enough from my family of origin, my family, from friends who've suffered from a lot of mental health issues. I feel like I can recognize when I'm out of my depth. I also have a lot of friends who are therapists. So, it's just information. I've talked a lot and I've read a lot of books, not self-help books, like books about mental health, books about, they're not academics. They're not the books that maybe you would be reading in school, but they're adjacent,
Sure.
perhaps. Like I just finished, I was telling you, My Grandmother's
Yeah.
Hands, things like that.
Stunning book, yeah.
So yeah. So, I've got some, I've got that level of knowledge and I feel like I've got a pretty good intuition. And so I know when I need to say, I need to tap out. And one of the questions I will ask people is, who are you talking to about this? Who else are you talking to about
Sure.
this? So that I already know if they're seeing a spiritual director or a therapist. Now, spiritual directors are not therapists. Spiritual directors do have certificates and they are trained to sit with a person and to listen to God with that person. Sometimes I think us Christians confuse spiritual direction with counseling with therapy because it feels more Christian and it feels more spiritual and less clinical. I see one of each. I see a spiritual director and I see a therapist. And often my spiritual director will tell me, yeah, you need to bring this to your therapist.
Which is such wisdom, right? The fact that they
Yes.
know their own scope of practice. And
Yeah.
I love the fact
Yeah.
that you see both, right? Because they're not mutually exclusive and they can
Yeah.
actually complement each other. And therapy can help your spiritual growth, right?
Yeah.
Even if the therapist themselves isn't spiritual, but just the whole practice of reflection, of insight, of sharing with somebody, of being seen, that's really helpful. All those are things that can contribute to somebody's spiritual growth at the end of the day.
Right. It all is part of healing. It's like if you go get surgery, the surgeon contributed on your knee, the surgeon contributed to the healing of your knee. And then you go to physical therapy to continue the healing of your knee. I mean, they both have their role in that. You don't just do surgery. You don't just do physical. Maybe you tried physical therapy and then they're like, I think you need surgery. So then you go to surgery and then you go back to physical therapy, right? Like you need both. They all work together. I feel that way about spiritual direction and therapy, that they work in tandem. Maybe there will come a day when I only need spiritual direction. I don't need to be seeing a therapist. That time is not now. So.
That. So with that, right, you've mentioned that you see a therapist, you see a spiritual director. How else do you take care of yourself?
I used to, I haven't gone in a long time, on a silent retreat.
I remember
I
that,
think
yeah.
this, yeah, silence is so good. The girls got big and our weekends were getting eaten up left and right. And I just haven't done that in so long. So yeah, now that, well, Jessica's back in the house, but I was gonna say now that both girls are out of the house, that's not true, but I have more space than I used to have. I'm really trying to develop some practices that I can actually get in a habit of because they're not getting interrupted all the time by change, the constant change of having kids in your house. And one of those is I just have not been reading for so long. I think between the pandemic and stress and everything, like any heavy reading felt so difficult. So I've heard that from a lot of people in healing vocations, helping vocations, that a lot of us quit reading. So I know I'm not the only one, but so I've started just trying to read more. I actually have an app that so I'm gamifying it a little bit, tracking how much I read every day.
What's the app? What's the
Make
app? Share it.
I use Bookly.
Okay.
I just use Bookly and it tracks. I can put the books I'm reading, whether it's audio, Kindle, or the actual book. And I start when I start reading, and then I can stop when I'm done reading. If I'm right now, I'm just trying to read 30 minutes a day. between all the books I'm reading. I've got a couple audiobooks. I've got some books on Kindle, and I feel good. If I hit 30, I feel great. If I hit more, then I feel even better. Yeah, I just feel better when I've done some reading.
Yeah.
Like read a book every day. I've taken all my social media apps off my phone so that I can't look at them on my phone. I have to open up my laptop to look at social media. And I interact with social media differently on my laptop than I do on my phone. It's less personal.
Nice.
And that feels like a spiritual practice to me. It just feels, and it limits how much time I can spend on social media.
I love that. So you've mentioned spiritual direction, therapy, reading, limiting your access to social media.
Yeah. And another thing I'm doing, and we talked about this a couple weeks ago when we saw each other in person.
Yes.
I am intentionally spending time with friends who are not part of my church.
That's huge, right? Because it can
I
become
love
very...
all my friends from my church, if you are listening, but I need to spend time with people who are not in my church.
Yeah, I mean, I get that, right? Sometimes the expectations, having to always fulfill a particular role, even if we know that we don't actually have to, there's still the subconscious mm-hmm. pressure to show up in a particular way and to hold space in a particular way.
Yes. And I've lived in Austin, you know, for like 50 years. And Austin is a revolving door. People come and then they leave. But mm-hmm. there are a handful of people like you and, you know, other folks who I just really feel, I haven't had, I mean, part of it was COVID, but, you know, I just haven't spent as much time in person with over the last few years. And I'm trying to be real intentional about making those lunch dates and coffee dates and hangout times.
I'm so glad because really I had a great time with you a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pivot to two more questions before we wrap up.
Yes.
The one is regarding my journey, and I have a question for you. So recently, and I think I might have mentioned this when we had coffee 2 weeks ago, was this idea about the over-anthropomorphism of God, how we have, you know, this idea that God made us in his image, and to understand him, we kind of created God in our image. And in doing so, we have limited and boxed our perspective of God and how that entity shows up in the world. And if, for example, we've separated the entity God from the entity's creation to such a degree that we think God created the river, but the river itself isn't God. And so we don't see God in things like nature, sunrises, sunsets, and also it impacts how we perceive environmentalism and the action we take to care for things like rivers, trees, oceans, the environment as a whole. Give me your perspective on that, because I think that in me trying to rekindle my spirituality responsibly and in a vital way that is dynamic and beautiful and good and healthy, one of the obstacles I'm encountering is something that you mentioned early on with regards to spiritual abuse. You know, that every time I try re-engage spiritually, I often am blocked by a memory or an interpretation of scripture or of a spiritual principle because of what a person said or did. Right. And so I'm trying to broaden this perspective and look outside of the tradition that I've learned, but I don't want to become another religion per se. I just want to broaden my perspective of God. And that feels kind of challenging. I don't actually have a question.
Yeah.
That's more of a monologue, and I'm open to your comments and encouragement.
I feel like I don't want to put words in your mouth, but like you don't want to be reactionary either.
Sure.
So I'm saying that because I have felt that way at times. I don't want to do this practice, pick up this practice, or have this belief in reaction to the thing I was taught that I don't think I believe anymore, or that I think was maybe even harmful to me.
But
am I believing this now in reaction to that, in rebellion against it, or is it really true? And those things I think are hard to differentiate. So as far as like nature, how we've created God in our image, I think that is such a healthy question to ask. I think it requires a lot of discernment. And I don't mean like in a, ooh, watch out, David.
Sure.
Way. Sure. I mean, I think that it is an important question that that requires us sitting in and really like listening to God, because, and that's what I mean by discernment, because of all the voices that want to tell us what we should think about that. Oh gosh, be careful. You can't, don't worship the river. Don't worship the trees. That's pantheism. But, you know, a person who I really admire her, and I found a lot of benefit from reading her, is an Episcopal priest who's retired now, Barbara Brown Taylor. She's lovely. And she wrote a book called Leaving Church, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago now. I was going to say 5 years ago, but it was so much longer than that. Everything feels 5 years ago, but it was actually 20. So her book was about when she retired from the priesthood and what that experience was like for her. And then she's got another book that I have, but that might be relevant to your question, called An Altar in the World. And so she talks a lot about finding God in nature. And she talks in Leaving Church. I just remember this specifically, about how a girl, she would lay in like a field, you know, where the grass was quite tall, and see the grass, you know, waving above her in the sky, and how connected she would feel to God in those moments, like just feeling the ground beneath her and seeing the grass and seeing the sky, and how connected she would feel to God. And that as she, how much she valued being a priest and how much she valued the church. And she's an amazing preacher and a brilliant theologian. And she does value those things, but that she felt like she left that part of herself when she became a priest. And that when she left the priesthood, she was able to kind of come back to some of those parts of herself. I don't think I quite understood it when I read that part of the book, but again, I think it was probably 15 or so years ago. And I think I probably appreciate that and understand that more as I've grown and matured. And I'm probably about the age that she was when she wrote that book now. So yeah.
I love that. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. I'm going to look up those works. But and I resonate with what you said about sitting and listening, you know, and for me, a lot of the challenge
and trusting that, ourselves.
See, and I think that's exactly, I think that for me, one of the biggest challenges has been trusting myself with regards to, you know, spiritual discernment, or trusting myself with regards to opinion, because of the way in the church we are conditioned to abdicate responsibility and trusting ourselves, right? Trusting our own intuition. I think that's beautiful. Thank you. I'm sure this is something that you and I will discuss at our next coffee. as we do wrap this up, though, if you could share encouragement with listeners in general, whether they're therapists, students, or just people that download the podcast because I blatantly self-promote it, what encouragement would you share with people? If you had something small to say, what would you say?
I don't want to make assumptions about therapists. You know, I would hope, I believe that therapists are trained to be as impartial as they can be, right? And that's part of your ethic, is when a client comes in, you have to just take them as they come, right? What you see is what you get.
Unconditional positive regard. I'm going to believe the best about you. Absolutely.
Even if you're like, whoa.
Even if I'm like, what? Are you crazy? I'm going to choose to believe the best about you.
Yes. Yes. So for people of faith who are like maybe resistant to clinical therapy. And I always, and when I say always, I actually mean the word always, because I've tried to strip always and never from my vocabulary unless I mean it. I always try to tell people they can see, I advise people to, it's okay to see a therapist who's a Christian, but I advise against a Christian therapist.
That is very nuanced. And I think people that know. I mean, it's one of those, like, if you know what April's saying right now. Right?
Yes.
Can you tell me what you mean by the difference between that?
It's what you were saying about when you were looking into getting your licensure, going to like the Christian counseling route, that certificate. And I know someone who did that, and he regrets ever having done it. because he feels like it was worthless time and money spent, because it's not, it's just not really, yeah, like what'd you call it? It's like personality assessment, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, it
That's
is.
What you got versus like going to an accredited university and going through that whole process of getting, you know, your master's
sure.
degree, going on getting a PhD, and then even pursuing other certifications after that and learning other modalities and things that you can, ways you can help your clients.
Yeah.
Which is clinical practice, not just doing mostly listening to people, which is super valuable.
Yeah.
I do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so important, because a lot of the times people need to be seen and validated and told that what they are feeling is real and true. And then the next step for a lot of them is to go home. And the next step for a whole lot of others of them is to go see somebody like you.
I love that, because I think there's just so much wisdom in what you just shared. And I think I know you fairly well. And one of the things I really appreciate about you is your ability to hold space for people and to listen. And, you know, I think you're the safe space that you provide, as not just as a pastor, but as a person, I think is so valuable and contributes so much to the healing of people, not just in your church, but pretty much anybody that you're in relationship mm-hmm. with. So I appreciate that so much. Thank you for your time
you.
Today. I love chatting with you. And I think that there needs to be a lot more cooperation and communication between clergy and therapists. I think there's a bent in counseling as a whole that is anti-Christianity very often because of the social justice component, because of advocacy, because of the political climate.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think both camps have a lot to offer. If people wanted to get hold of you, April, how would they get hold of you? I think you have some wisdom to offer. So if anybody wants to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Probably email.
They can access you via your email, which will be in the podcast notes. Thank you so much. I appreciate you and value all that you bring to the table, and especially your humor, which we're not going to share. We're not going to share the humor.
We're not sharing that.
We're
here.
Not sharing that.
We'll do it different. We'll do it after dark.
And after dark. And that's incriminating to some degree. Again, thank you so much. I'm going to shut
thank
the
you
podcast
for asking.
Off now. Of course.
This is so important. Yeah.
That was April Carley, pastor of Mustard Seed Church in Austin, Texas. If you want to get hold of April at all to consult or for any wisdom, because she has plenty to offer, you'll see her email in the notes below. Thank you for joining us today on Project I Am. May you be well.
Today will be glorious. Put on your sunglasses, sunscreen, and sun smiles. You're gonna love it.